Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com. Welcome to The Rest Is Politics Leading with me, Alistair Campbell.
And with me, Rory Stewart. And today we have with us Anthony Gormley. And Anthony Gormley is a sculptor. He's a very, very central to British public art, British sculpture. He will be, I suspect, frustrated that he's often introduced as being associated with Angel of the North, which, of course, is in every child's textbook now. It's one of those images along with the London Eye, which kind of define our country. But he's in many different conversations. I mean, Alistair and I had breakfast with somebody this morning, a British Muslim, who was talking about just having seen Another Place, which is a collection of 100 cast iron sculptures of humans on a beach at Crosby, Merseyside. He has a career which we can get into a little bit and explore, but which really, I guess, took off in mid-1980s. He won the Turner Prize. He's a knight. He's one of the kind of celebrated figures of British art, but he's particularly interested in the body. He's got a lot to say about religion. He's got a lot to say about politics, and I think quite a lot to say about public art. So we're very, very lucky to have him. And of course, Alistair and I are beginning with a slight apology that normally I think you're interviewed by art critics who would be much, much more knowledgeable about your corpus of work than either of us. But thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can we go right back to the beginning? Born in 1950, Hampstead Garden suburb, German mother, very Catholic, Irish father. And I'm fascinated by your relationship with faith and religion, with that sort of bring. I mean, your full name is Anthony Mark David Gormley. So called, I read, because that has the same initials as Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam, to the greater glory of God. So we're talking quite a dad.
Yeah, that was a bit of a, ring around my neck. Absolutely extraordinary, I suppose, household routine of prayer. Get up in the morning, you say your prayers by your bed, then you go down and you have breakfast, and there may be grace before breakfast, but there'll certainly be grace before and after lunch, and certainly before and after dinner. Age 6 or 7, cycling down to Temple Fortune to serve. I can't remember whether it was Father Collingwood or Father Delaney, but anyway, whoever it was, he'd got quite gaga by the time I was doing it, and I was age 10, and I would have to nudge him on a bit to keep going, because otherwise we'd be there forever. But anyway, Catholicism was really, I think, the rule of the carrot of heaven, the stick of hell, was very high in, I guess, the moral kind of outline of my life's purpose.
Also, in your description of your childhood, you also say that after church on a Sunday, your father would often take you to the British Museum or the National Gallery. And literally, as a sort of 6, 7-year-old, you'd be wambling around the National Gallery.
Very young. And if you can imagine what that's like for a little toddler, you know, weedy little chap, like looking up at those great bulls from the Palace of Sardon, or the head of Ramses II, this thing made out of granite that is like 12 times the volume of an actual head. And I think that those experiences of looking at things from the deep past, that in terms of these sacred bulls or lions, these winged mythological figures, they're a kind of example of the imagination, that actually you don't have to stay with what you've got, you can transform it. And in terms of the heads of Amenhotep or Ramses, this is what we had to make in order to understand ourselves.
You weren't thinking that age 6.
No, I wasn't. No, I was just dumbstruck. I was thinking these are things from a long, long time ago, and they're still here, and they make me feel small, and they make me slightly scared.
I'm the father of a 6-year-old. And in fact, sitting in front of you on your desk is 3 objects that my 6-year-old just gave me. When I take him around the Victoria and Albert Museum, he can get a bit bored. Right? He can be quite liable to say he'd rather be back home watching Pokemon. Were you quite an unusual child. I mean, you didn't ever feel, oh, why is my dad dragging me around this museum and I'd rather be back watching a
I don't know. I just think that that room, particularly the Egyptian room, is so generous in the kind of offer. You know, you can look down on a Middle Kingdom tomb that has Nut, Queen of the Night, kind of carved in very, very shallow relief in its bottom. And she's quite a sexy woman. She's got, you know, her breasts are kind of feeding the night. And then there were, in those days, before they made the Great Court, this wonderful little passageway that had all of the grave goods of fantastic pharaonic, afterlife accoutrements, tiny scarabs and all kinds of things made of gold and lapis. And it was just, it was a treasure house.
So you were the youngest of seven?
Yeah.
Were your six older siblings very similar to you or very different?
No, we were all absolutely different. And I have to explain that, my mother went to Canada. She might have ended up in an internment camp like my grandmother, Omi. And she had only been married with my father for 5 or 6 years. And then she went for a further 6 years. So all of the pre-war, the four of my siblings that were born pre-war, spent 6 years without a father in the Lake of Bays in the summer, north of Ontario. And the minute they got old enough, the minute they were 18 or so, they just went back to Canada. This was the promised land. This was where you somehow could be free. You could kind of do whatever you wanted. And so it was a strange thing, a big house that was built by my father that faced T9 on the Hampstead golf course. looked like Bauhaus to the south and kind of Lutyens to the north. And very strange, because it was painted in eggshell, green, and then textured sort of brown, dado level. It was made to last, but it was actually more like an institution than my school. So actually being sent to Yorkshire was just an unbelievable liberation.
To go to a Catholic boarding school.
Yeah, go to a monastic school it was just absolute fantastic. I mean, somehow just the space, the fact that, you know, up there were the moors, down there was the valley, little beck flowing through it, there were forests, and then all these significant others that helped me do stuff.
Can I just bring you back for a moment to your father? Because obviously the impression maybe that listeners get is this extraordinary man with his kind of brown dado walls taking his children either to church or to the National Gallery, seven children. But give us more of a sense of what he was like as the father and some of the more, I suppose, active, loving aspects of him.
He was incredible, because on the one hand, he was a tyrant. On the other, he was just incredibly good fun. He used to have annoying habits. He would like put all his shaving foam on and then go around singing Glory, Glory, Hallelujah while trying to give us a kiss to get us out of bed.
With the shaving foam.
And singing Glory, Glory, Hallelujah because of the religious significance?
Well, no, because it's a bloody, you know...
So get big, out of bed but, him.
Yeah,
right,
like
okay.
Belting him. No, he was an incredible sailor. We had this boat called the Sea Trout, which is an old clinker built boat, and he would just set out from we had as a kind of country place this old stables that our main house had burnt down, and he would launch this boat, quite a big boat with big old red sails, and he'd say, "Come on, we're going to the Nab." The five of us or the six of us would get aboard. Anyway, no, he was the first. Or one of the first people to get the permission to produce penicillin. You know, I didn't see him that much because he was always off to India or Australia or Singapore or Hong Kong. It's hard not to be very admiracious of a man that, you know, fought in the First World War, married a German, that made his own life. I mean, and at the same time, you know, he was brought up by Morris Brothers and he wanted absolute discipline. So he had to do, you know, first steps in Latin primer twice a week. And if you didn't get your declensions right, you got smacked. So there were times when, you know, I would be in tears in the study, not for having failed my Latin.
And how did your relationship with faith develop through your life? When did you lose it?
I lost it in my first term at university, but I think the truth is that I, as I think all young boys who go into that kind of atmosphere, you know, I was thinking, do I have a vocation? Am I going to become a Benedictine? Because they were inspirational. I know that Ampleforth has fallen under a very dark cloud, and for rightful reasons. But I had no experience of any sexual impropriety whatsoever. And all I can tell you is the support that I had. I want to tell you about the art room. The art room was in the oldest part of the school, 18th century building, right in the middle of it, and it was always open. So you could get down there before General Assembly, as it were, in the morning and start something off. You could rush up there at 11 o'clock and kind of see how it was going. Anyway, it was just fantastic. And the support that I was given by Father Martin Haig, my lay teacher, John Bunting, an incredible sculptor who actually embodied what, in a way, the vocational life of a sculptor was.
You know, did you already know by then that you were an artist?
Well, they were incredibly encouraging.
Did you know?
Yeah. Well, I knew that I wanted to make things. That was so important to me that I realized very early on that making was a form of thinking, that making was a form of communicating, that maybe I implicitly trusted more than words. I know that we are exchanging words now, and I guess our listeners are listening through the agency of words. But in the end, I don't trust words as much as acts, and acts that are embodied into material mean the most to me.
There's a paradox, isn't there? It's the whole thing. I mean, this is an incredibly disembodied form podcast. People will be yes. listening to this as they run or they're doing their ironing, and yet you are somebody who's all about touching stuff and being in a particular place. This will be floating in people's ears in the United States at some weird time. And so
this is the trouble of our time, isn't it? We're all distracted. We are not in the present moment. We are usually in two places at once. We are here, but we're also thinking about there or someone over there or something that somebody has told us to do. And I think that rooting in first-hand palpable experience is so important in a cyber age.
We'll come back to your life in a second, but maybe this is a chance to introduce a little bit, listeners, to your sculpture, because one of the things that's striking about it is that you are insisting on place. So, for example, the Angel of the North is made with people from that area, and there's a real sense of its industrial heritage. In a field, for example, you're getting hundreds of people to make little clay images. In the work that you did inside Australia, you get, again, a sense of participating in other people's bodies. There's a sort of sense of teamwork. Tell us about these sculptures, or try to bring them alive for the audience, and explain the way in which they relate to touch and place.
To start with the angel, since, as you're right, that's the thing that I'm most kind of associated with.
Does it irritate you? Rory said it irritated you.
No. I think I just always have to restate the fact that this was made through collective will and collective action. And that is what I feel so humbled by, but also so inspired by. Art comes out of life. It should go back into life. For me, I can just remember going around, you know, Hartlepool and Middlesbrough with the maquette in the back of a Luton van, opening up the kind of shutter at the back while there was a bunch of people in their brown coats or their overalls. And I'd say, how can we make this, mate? And it was just fantastic. This is a time when Swan Hunters had closed down, and one by one, all those amazing shipyards on the Tyne that I grew up watching on the news, you know, again, a very similar kind of memory to seeing those Assyrian bulls. These massive things going down the slipway, bigger than the houses that were either side. And you see them in black and white, kind of suddenly this thing that's the size of a cathedral suddenly moves. Anyway, I had to find the people that had made that shape out of 6mm ship plate and learned how to bend it. Find them and say, let's make something together that tells the world what you're capable of in a different form.
This thing sticks its wings out, and has to deal with 100 mile per hour winds. So it's a massive kind of problem for it not to blow over.
There was a lot. I needed a lot of help. You know, I was molded with my arms out. I did have to have sticks because it takes about an hour and a half. you know, but that was my very kind of small beginning. I then took that design. We had to digitize it, which we did with the help of Newcastle University. They then like transferred it into a buildable thing where we used the ribs of a ship on the outside to be the form of this thing. But for me, this is, you know, this connects with the cathedrals. It connects that, you know, we live in a time when art has been institutionalized and commodified. And yet, for most of its, if we think from Paleolithic times onwards, for most of the 25,000 years that art has been part of our evolution, it has been made usually in community, for community. And this is a continuation.
Where does your creative impulse come from? Do you ever know? When you have a particular idea of something you want to do, what's the feeling like? How does it feel when you something new comes into your head?
Well,
and you think,
it usually starts like, I'm opening a little book. It's a Muji book that is the size of a passport, and I've just got it out of my pocket.
It's a nice colour passport, not like the new ones.
It's true. This is a red passport, not a blue one. But anyway, it'll start like this, little. But this comes from what I'm doing in the studio. So what's happening in the studio then gets translated into this, and then I'm thinking, how can I push it further? So this is, believe it or not, a body, but it's a body as a zone of energy. We're making this, but at the same time, I'm trying to push it. I'm trying to say, how can we lose the body entirely, or lose the body enough so that you don't know whether the energy field is created by the body or the body created by the energy field? And that's what really, we talked about my work as if it was always like 200 tons of the angel or the yeah, I guess another place is about 60 tons of iron.
And sometimes enormous, right? So the angel, I think, sits on 100 square metres of concrete plinth to stop it coming over.
Sorry about that. I am embarrassed by how much concrete.
But what about the bigger picture idea, as it were, of your kind of obsession with the body and actually with your own body? Where does that idea come from that then informs so much of what you've done?
The Ur story is being sent up for an enforced rest after lunch, and being a good Catholic boy, being told not to move, being told this is, but not being able to sleep, and just having this experience of lying completely still and becoming aware of the space within the body. And it would start with this claustrophobic, red, kind of hot space but behind closed eyes. And as I got more familiar with it, because this was a repeated discipline, it became cooler and bigger until it became this space in which there was no objects, there was no edge, there was no bounding condition. It had infinite extension. And that experience as a very young child was then reinforced when I went to India and started studying meditation.
That's a sort of strange connection between you and me, and also Yuval Noah Harari, who we just interviewed, which is that we all meditate in the Vipassana tradition. And I'm about to go on another silent retreat next
good
month.
Ten day.
Yeah, and Yuval has just come off a 40-day.
Yeah, no, he's impressive.
But it seems to lead in very, very different directions, doesn't it? I mean, obviously, at the moment at which you were talking, I can recognize what you're talking about. But for Yuval, the experience of meditation leads to him being interested in the disembodied, or the sort of virtual, the way in which humans might escape their bodies entirely and become, you know, robots or artificial intelligence. With you, the same tradition has led to a desire to be really kind of rooted and material and there on a beach or there on a hillside.
Yeah, good point. I think that the truth is that experience of the darkness of the body for me was a reversal. You could say that all Platonic, but also Christian kind of cosmologies are towards the light. Darkness is somehow evil and is full of repression and kind of motivations that we can't understand, but leads to violence and despair. And I discovered in Vipassana, completely the opposite, that within that darkness of the body is actually potential. In coming to terms, you could say, with the void within, suddenly I was released from all of this guilt, all of this, well, the original sin that Catholicism had landed me with. But it's interesting for me. I think of what I do, or certainly if we think of another place, these are industrially made fossils that simply indicate a place of human time.
Just to remind people, another place are the statues on Crosby Beach, which over time are beginning to get barnacles and rust and adjust endlessly to the horizon.
Yeah, and they spread. They're about 200 meters apart, so they're extremely isolated.
And it's even a big, it's a big space, right?
Yeah, so they're 3 miles of coastline and about a kilometer out to sea. And when the sea comes in, they disappear, apart from the ones that are above the tide line. And the ones that are furthest out at high tide, because it's a tipped plane, 8 meters below the surface. And this, I mean, for me, what is this? This is, yes, making art in the time of mechanical reproduction. So the works become a field. You can't say this is a singular, unique object. It's a field effect. And the viewer, the participator, is invited to be part of that field. You're part of the picture.
Can I ask, I'm going to hand back to Alison one second, but one thing that interests me is how often you work in iron, steel.
Yeah. No, it is iron. It's important. It might start as steel. So it starts as, you know, brake discs, and then it's melted down, reverts to the same condition of the core of this planet.
But I'm interested in why the fact that you work less often in sort of silica-based things, you're less often working with sandstone or sometimes with clay, not really with glass, which I would think is more sort of organic.
Ethereal,
and tactile,
perhaps.
Whereas steel, well, I suppose steel is more, lacks that kind of transparency or porosity of these silica-based things. I mean, iron seems to be, you know, it conducts. It's metallic. I mean, it's got an edge which these sort of silica-based clays and glass, sandstone lack.
You're thinking about your turquoise mountain glasses. Well, at least I am. Immediately you start thinking. I think of these incredibly lucid blue glasses with tiny bubbles in. I'm going to say something that may sound totally counterintuitive. I think of my work as being about space, not being about objects, but how can you activate space? I want to use the density of mass as a catalyst for making these fields in which your movement, your space-time experience is amplified. I can't think of a better way of doing it. I think of them, you know, as being 21st century industrial time equivalent of standing stones. They're an attempt to put human biological time in relation to sidereal planetary time. And I can't think of any way of doing it better. At the same time, you know, I am making works that have no body reference, because it's the viewer's body that then becomes the subject of the work. And these are works like Breathing Room or Clearing. I don't know if either of you went to the Royal Academy show, but Clearing is 11 kilometers of endless, a singular line without beginning or end, that is like a big scribble, but it's in the room, it's up against the ceiling, it's down on the floor, it's bouncing off the walls, and it feels like the most crazy kind of, well, I call it a quantum drawing, because it won't persist within, as it were, the Euclidean geometry of our chosen habitat. What it is an energy field, and you have to duck and dive in order to be, so it's sort of like a Twombly painting, but you're in it.
What role does the art that you do have in the community where that art exists? And given this is a politics podcast primarily, how do you define the role of art within the political debate?
I think art is a fundamental human, or the making of things, the making of images, the making of marks is a fundamental human need. It has been part of our survival, as I said earlier, from Paleolithic times. It is also a basic human right. The first thing to say is art should be on the curriculum. It is absolutely necessary, irrespective. I'm aware that I had a very privileged background, but I think you give any child from the age of two onwards a sheet of paper and a way of making a mark, and they'll go. At a certain point, because of our culture, they become self-conscious about that, in a way, need to lead, even if it's just a trace. There's a sense in which I have affected some part of the world by that trace, that making of a mark. And I think that is a absolute key in self-determination, in the building of a psyche, of a character, of a person, of a self. And without it, we are victims of a late capitalist world, and we're all kind of racing one against the other as to what little kind of hole in this cliff face we can occupy. If Demis Hassabis or Sam Altman are right, that AI is going to solve intelligence, it's going to make energy free, we are all going to now become redundant. Well, we better all become artists. We better find a meaningful way of making sense.
Recently, you had in this country, the Arts Council of England making rather strange noises, I thought, about the funding of the organisations which get their funding being told not to get too political. Now, what did you make of that? And what does that say about where we are culturally?
It's an absolute disaster. I have no idea. The Arts Council was founded by Maynard Keynes with the idea of arm's length policy. There should be no... I mean, you know, we will end up with a Goering of... I mean, it's just...
State-sponsored propaganda.
We cannot allow art to become propaganda. Art schools are the reason that British art has become of international significance is because of the quality of our art schools. That is something that we inherited from the 60s. I ask myself, where does alternative thinking come from to businesses as usual? It will always come from, you know, usually people who are dyslexic, who have had to find other ways of communicating. And where have the nests for those souls to grow been? Well, it has been art schools. We wouldn't have got the Beatles without art schools. And somehow there was a change in the 80s, when late 70s and 80s, when art schools started behaving like universities. Things that used to be about, learning from the guy next door, or being taught by an artist that was making his name or her name out in the international art world, was replaced by a lot of administering art tutors. Anyway, I mean, I feel that art schools have now become extremely dependent on particularly Southeast Asian students that often don't have English as their first language. That's no problem in per se. Actually, you have to be quite rich.
As you say, the UK does have a pretty amazing reputation in arts and culture. What I'm hearing is that you worry that might be at risk if there's this kind of cultural Maoism.
Well, we've had this
Maoism.
Terrible government, which has kind of consistently undermined the very thing that people, when you think about what a culture's values are, where do you go? You go to its music, its dance, its theatre, and its art. And yet, this is the thing that has been consistently undermined, both in education and in the support of our institutions. Having said that, I don't want to be totally negative. We have maintained the absolute importance of keeping our museums free and open to everyone. And I think that the art schools continue, but I am very, very aware they're underfunded, and it seems like they depend for 30% of their funding on foreign students.
I've got this thing that I keep banging on about, that I want, if we do get a Labour government, that they have a sort of deliberate strategy of trying to brand the UK as a kind of cultural superpower. If you were tasked with trying to build the arguments and the policies and the programs that might allow that to happen, what sort of advice would you feed in?
Well, I just think I think that the 7.5 billion that the creative industries bring into the Treasury is not the argument that I would use. I would always use the intrinsic value of art, and the fact that this is, politicians come and go, but the art is the trace that we leave of our hopes and our fears. And I would say, you know, I'm just very depressed by the fact that in terms of our government kind of hierarchy, it's always the cultural minister that is the at the bottom rung.
You'd elevate that.
I would elevate that. I mean, you know, when you have André Malraux, you get something. When you get Jack Lang, you have something absolutely extraordinary that happens.
And Nadine Dorris isn't quite André Malraux, is your suggestion?
I think that's Lucy, a way of
Lucy Fraser
it.
Is not Jack Lang. Is this what we're hearing?
Well, I mean, we had Greg Gowrie. We have had some great and inspirational arts ministers, and we need them again. I mean, I think to fulfill your ambition of Britain as a creative soft power force in the world, I think we need a minister who really believes that, and hopefully is a. I mean, now the culture minister in waiting is a cellist, and that gives me hope. And when I learned the other day that
the prime minister in waiting is a flautist.
Yes, I heard about his time in the conservatoire, and that gave me hope. I have to say, I did feel. Maybe we're up for a change.
Okay, Anthony, Rory, let's have a quick break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell us a little bit about international politics and art. I mean, I notice you've done big exhibitions in Petersburg and I believe in Moscow. What do you feel looking back at exhibiting in sort of Putin's Russia? And
well, I wouldn't do it now. I believe in the central role of art as a bridge across gender, race, language, and political system. So I had a show last year in China. I will do a show this year in China, in spite of the fact that Xi Jinping's regime is horrendous.
So why you would do China but you wouldn't do Russia?
Well, I think that everything that Putin has represents and has done, I feel that his whole regime. In doing one, I would be supporting his regime, and I can't.
Whereas you feel that with Xi, you can remain critical, but you can still do your art.
The interesting thing is that the upper echelons of the Chinese Communist Party are pretty disinterested in art, and it is really interesting that actually some of the most groundbreaking art being made today is being made by Chinese artists. That's because they've always been somehow below the political kind of horizon in terms of the power of that nation. Yeah, I won't work in Saudi Arabia, for example, for similar reasons. A lot of money in that particular.
Yeah, tell us a bit about money and art, because I guess that is an interesting thing, which is that by the time you get to your stature, you can become very, very wealthy. And I suppose one could develop a taste for money. That must, I mean, I don't want to push this particularly on you personally, but do you feel that for the really sort of famous celebrity artists and sculptures, that money can be a complicated factor and that it can draw their art in directions in which they don't want to go? Or?
Yeah, there's absolutely no question. But I'm also worried about that as a model. I think that, you know, art is a vocation. You don't choose it, it chooses you. There has been, I think, one of the downsides of the YBA, you know, the Damien Hirst kind of generation, was that now, if you haven't been approached by a gallery by the time you do your degree show at art school, you feel you've failed.
And in your case, it was a much slower burn, wasn't it? You were born in
1950,
and you made it big by the time you were in the 30s. So
I don't know about made it big. I didn't have a gallery. I started working with White Cube in 91, 92.
Your family into your 30s, almost till you were 40, wouldn't have seen you as a great rock star who was making huge income.
My father would have thought that I was a complete failure.
Did they encourage you?
Yeah, they did in the end. I mean, my dad died in 1974, so he didn't see me, I was still at art school, so he didn't see me.
But did he understand why you wanted to be at art school?
Yeah, he did in the end. It was funny, he took me off to Core Abbey and on the Isle of Wight for a retreat. The wonderful abbot monk, Father Anthony there. And that was really good. I mean, it was good for me to have that reconciliation. But they let me go to India. I mean, I just disappeared. After Cambridge, I just disappeared for 3 years. You know, it took me a year to get to India. The Indian-Pakistan war was going on. I went through the Wagga corridor, met these Tibetans. And they said, oh, come with me. Come with us. We're going to Dalhousie. And I'd known Charles Hastings, who was really into Tibetan Buddhism, so Mahayana school. And I said, yeah, well, I'll come with you. And then I met Goenka.
Tell us a little bit about, just briefly, and it's maybe more of interest to me than all listeners, but tell us a little bit about Goenka and that whole tradition.
Well, what was extraordinary was how practical he was.
So he was a Burmese businessman.
In the tradition of Lady Sayadaw. So he was part of the International Buddhist Center in Rangoon. But his whole thing was, and this is a continuation of where we were talking before, first-hand experience. You know, you can know about Buddhism intellectually, but I want you to experience it. So you do. I mean, we should do this now. I mean, that gateway for me was how do you achieve concentration. So let's try it. Let's just close our eyes. The first 3 days of a 10-day course are Anapana.
Sorry, we stay here for 10 days?
No, we're just going to do about 3 minutes. So concentration on breathing. Now, just breathe through your nose. As you breathe in, you can feel that cool air passing your upper lip. As you breathe out, you can feel that warm air touching your upper lip. Anyway, the breath is an extraordinary thing because it is both aleatoric, in other words, it's controlled by the systems of the body, but it can also be controlled, you know, you can force your breathing. So it's an amazing indicator of this bridge between, you could say, conscious and unconscious, or the limbic system and your conscious kind of controlling mind. Anapana then continues if you manage to maintain your concentration on that point on your upper lip, you can begin to make what they call a bij, just a point of samadhi or concentration. And at a certain point, you move that point of concentration to the top of your head and you begin to move it in a spiral manner through the whole volume of your body. That was my introduction to, I think, the first-hand experience of a form of knowledge that had nothing to do with books, that had nothing to do with being able to reproduce the great thoughts or the histories of our species, embedded my consciousness back into being, using existence as a form of examining existence.
One sort of also gets echoes of I suppose you spent nearly 2 years meditating in India, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And as you say, you were also interested in being a monk, your interest in vocation.
I was very influenced by Joseph Beuys, and but I have never thought of myself as a shaman.
As a guru.
Or as a guru.
Right.
Absolutely not. But I absolutely believe in the idea of the art object or the experience of the field of art as a catalyst for mindfulness. I really do. I really believe that.
The other thing that strikes me looking at your work is how often, you mentioned standing stones, but, you know, your little clay figures look like terracotta funerary objects from the Near East. Your standing figures look like extraordinary kind of ancestral statues stripped of all personality. I think you say, you know, they're not George IV, they're not Apollo, they're figures like the figures that we take from the ancient world. And you studied, I guess, anthropology, archaeology. So tell us a little bit about the kind of ancient in your work.
Well, I guess I want my work to be timeless. I'm really pleased that I haven't been caught by fashion. I don't think my work kind of fits in. Oh, I that's what they were making in Britain in 1980. They can't box me in to that kind of thing. I think that our species has always found it necessary to make models of itself in order to understand itself. And I go back to the stencils on the cave of Peshmel, or, well, anywhere, on the Maros caves in Sulawesi.
You're holding up your hand and sort of illustrating
people. You chew charcoal, or you blow ochre, and you leave this sense of touch between the skin of the earth and the skin of a living body as a kind of marker in time. That is one very, very strong, reference for me. I think of my works as shadows, in a sense. They indicate indexically, they are forensic proof of where a body once was, but by implication, where anybody could be.
Alistair, can I bring you in for a second? So you're somebody who loves sport, loves physicality, loves keeping fit, loves going for these kind of amazing freezing immersions in water. How does this sort of talk about body sit with you and talk about art sit with you?
I love listening to Anthony talk about art. I watched a program about you where you were immersing yourself in crude oil and then sort of splattering your body onto a big sheet of paper, which then becomes a beautifully hung work of art in a wonderful exhibition. I think I got a better understanding from your earlier explanation of what you were like, what you were thinking, what you were feeling as a child. I can now see the link between that experience and when I look at some of your figures dotted around the coastline. I love the fact that we have some of the best, because I'm determined, Roy, to bring this back to politics at some point. I love the fact that we have these voices who are very definitively British and who express what they do about art and relate that to who and what we are as people. Mm. I think that's very, very powerful. That's what I mean in part by creating a cultural superpower. I think we do. It's partly, I know you prefer to make rather than to speak, but it's partly about our language. So I'm fascinated by what people like you do and what they give. And I think it does relate to our soft power. And I don't think we exploit it nearly enough, which is why I want to bring you back to the red and the blue passport. And I want to ask you, what's your assessment of what Brexit has done to our standing in the world and our status as a cultural superpower?
It's an absolute disaster. It's a fundamental failure of imagination. It's a fundamental betrayal of what was a creative necessity after the Second World War. All of the sacrifices that my grandparents and my parents made in order to make a free, open Europe, that we were so much part of the creation of, and we threw it away for nothing, for nothing. It makes me angry and sad.
Strikes me to must also make you sad, thinking about the fact that none of the political parties at the moment pushing to reopen it or to even imagine even single markets or customs union ratio. I mean, and that makes me think that there's a problem in politics, to bring it back to politics and Alistair's prompting, partly of imagination, but also of hope. I mean, I'm thinking about this because we're thinking about Israel-Gaza a lot at the moment on the podcast. Very striking that nobody seems, Alistair and I were talking about this at breakfast, nobody seems to actually have the confidence to envisage a Middle East peace process, a long-term solution, a settlement anymore. It seems to be a sort of terrible lack of hope.
Well, I think that we're you know, I always go back to E.O. Wilson and, you know, we have medieval institutions, Paleolithic emotions and God-given technology, but the way that those things interact is all fractious. And the fact is that I think of our politics as always defined in a way by past actions. This is like almost a karma thing from Buddhism. It seems to me that the Tory-Labour kind of dialectic is something that might have made sense in the 40s, but just doesn't make sense now. So the allegiances that politics leads us to have to fit ourselves into don't fit the world in which we have the entire knowledge of humankind in our smartphones. You know, I think, yes, we need proportional representation. Yes, we need, in a way, we need a politics that is to do with issues and the necessary things that will make our species flourish. Not this endless kind of dialectic between worker and businessman or something that seems to come from another age, a kind of master-slave mentality that just isn't true for now.
What do you hope for out of the coming election?
Hoping that Keir Starmer will get in. He's a thoroughly decent bloke. I mean, in some ways, after the charisma of Boris, to actually have somebody who is grounded, who talks about his father as, this toolmaker who was somehow, denied by Thatcher and her obsession with Milton Friedman economics. His desire to reassert apprenticeship and I hope, I heard him the other night just say, yes, we've got to get art back into the curriculum. He's got my vote. He has definitely.
Where did you say that?
In a meeting in Covent Garden where he met a few people from the art.
Oh, you're one of those. Oh, I know about those.
I hope. I hope that there will be real transformation.
But that's the hope. But do you? I was at an event last night with Rory's hero, David Gawk, and although there was 500 people there, one of whom thought the Tories could win the election, the rest no chance. But there was a sentiment, maybe they were wanting change and they want to see the back of this government, but not that much hope about the scale of transformation, but you actually seem a little bit more hopeful.
Yeah, all of the Tories' talk of levelling up hasn't happened. I feel more faith, Keir, in his sort of ground up attitude for what is necessary, will think seriously about the infrastructure of this country. I mean, the whole drama of HS2 and the lack again of imagination here. You know, we should have in Manchester a place where a internationally, important university doing important work on things like graphene should be associated with, as it were, the business acumen to put those revelations into products. I mean, that's been the disaster for Britain, that we've always had remarkable ideas, but then realized somewhere else. And we need to do it here. But we need to create our confidence in our own future by giving the infrastructure for that future to grow. And I think in the hands of Keir Starmer, that's more likely to happen than if we carry on with the present lot.
Let me maybe sort of push it again one stage. So I think everything you say about Keir Starmer seems right. I still sense a lack. Now, if I think about problems that we face, how on earth do we actually get the NHS and public services working? And we're spending a phenomenal amount of money. And our doctors and nurses are run off their feet and patients are getting a rubbish deal. AI is coming and it might wipe out 30-40% of the jobs in this country. It might also be an extraordinary opportunity for productivity, but do we have a government that's kind of bold enough in recognizing those dangers and challenges? What are we really doing about climate when we've just taken away the $26 billion that Labour committed? Where is Britain's leadership on Middle East peace process and the statements and ceasefire? So I'm going to sort of push you on this question of imagination and hope.
It was very galling to read BEA Systems are recording a profit of $127 billion.
Which is the defense manufacturer making weapons.
Yeah. You know, this is still an important prop in our GDP. I am aware that this isn't just our problem, the aging population and, you could say the diminishing ability, it seems, of the Western world to replace itself with the same problem as Japan. So what is the answer? Well, in my view, I think Kate Raworth's donut economics is the answer. We've got to give up on the idea of endless growth. It's so obvious. You know, we've got a planet with limited resources, with defined resources, and the goal of endless growth is impossible. So we've got to learn from what, in a way, COVID told us, that actually we can live very differently. Why hasn't
and yet the problematic, which Alistair and I keep coming back to, is, and we did when we interviewed Kate and touched on when we interviewed Caroline Lucas, is the politics of that is so difficult to imagine.
Well, that's why we've got to have different politics, isn't it? That whole thing, knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing, is at the root of all of this.
Okay, well, let me finish my last question and then I'll hand back to Alistair to finish. So sitting in front of you are three objects which my six-year-old brought. One of them is which you have in your hand, which is a fossilized 150 million year old tree, which has been polished. One of them is a piece of copper and one of them is a piece of amber. And I wonder whether you just tell us a little bit about these objects. And I suppose one thing I'm interested in is these are objects that have some of the quality of your work, maybe have less human intervention. Nature itself has been involved in the creation of them more directly.
I'm holding this ancient tree in my right hands, or a part of it that has been polished to a very, very high level of sheen. It's cool. And if you look at it, it has all of these extraordinary colours, some sort of light yellows that are almost translucent, and then darker, almost dried blood colour ruby red. And it fits in the hand in an extraordinary way. It sort of settles like an egg into the palm of your hand. And there's a sense in which, yes, you're communicating with something that has been around before you and will be around after you. And I guess, you know, that reference to the standing stone, what is a standing stone? A standing stone is a marker in space that makes you aware of your time and, in a way, invites you to spend time with it. Well, I think that's what this stone does. We're here for such a short time. You know, if this, you said this was 130 million years old, so from the Cambrian period. We're an extraordinarily successful species. We have learnt to live in every environment that this planet offers, apart from Antarctica and the Arctic. But at the same time, that very adaptability that has come out of our extraordinary extended arm, our technology, is the very thing that is going to kill us and perhaps a very high proportion of the biosphere. So as I sit here, I've got this ancient tree part in my right hand and a piece of copper in my left that feels like a copper nugget. It's almost like this has come dug out of the ground. It feels a bit like a meteorite as well. Mind you, most meteorites are actually iron. But there's something lovely about this as well. This talks about the mutability of matter, because it's sort of, it's globular. It's small, again, very, very dense. Copper has a density not dissimilar to gold or lead. This just reminds me of the way that we talk about our evolution in terms of material. Stone Age, Iron Age, Bronze Age. This material was what was found in yeah, in river systems and in nodes in the ground, made our first tools. So this sort of this reminds me, in my right hand is something that reminds me of kind of the age of the planet, but then also the development of the biosphere. In my left hand, this tells me about our relationship with the materials of the world and how they've come to define us.
Well, I've listened to you all day. Let me just ask you this. Is legacy important to you? When you do sort of finally...
Yeah, kick the bucket.
Kick the bucket and pop your clogs and disappear. Will it matter to you that you've left these so many objects in different parts of the world? Will that be important to you and that they will survive and endure?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what sculpture is for. It's about saying that there is continuity and that I can talk through these things to people who aren't yet born. That, and I hope there is an inherent, you know, when we talked about hope earlier, to me, the difference between a painting or a photograph is that this is not, a sculpture is not the picture of something. It is in the world, and by implication, it changes the world. So the making of an object that you put out on the beach, on a mountain, in the street, is an expression of a desire to contribute to the evolving world, but also a prayer of hope that it will continue, that it will flourish, that our species will learn to live with all other living beings, as the Buddha hoped we would.
This is an impossible question, I suspect, for you to answer, but if there's only one piece that you've done that you're allowed to take with you, what would it be?
Take with me where?
To wherever we go, and you can be pre or post Catholic.
I think it's very difficult. This is like asking a parent to choose one of their children as their favourite. But I think probably the model of my work, which is field, where I go and ask people to repeat this action of taking a lump of clay, allowing the space between their hands to become a generative womb out of which form arises, stand it apart from them and make it conscious by giving it two eyes, simply pushing the point of a pencil or a piece of wood into its head, that then multiplies and becomes this landscape that completely fills whatever space it's in, whether that's a supermarket, a cathedral, or an art gallery, looks back at us and makes us the focus of its gaze and says, we are the spirit of the ancestors and we are the spirit of the unborn. What are you doing, the living, to make the continuity of life happen?
Now, Rory, before we close, do you see any physical similarity between me and Anthony?
Yeah, I think you're both big white guys. Yeah,
I'm going to tell you a story that I had to do about you don't know this because you weren't there, but I was in your studio.
Oh, when?
You've also got actually big white guys with similar noses and ears. Actually,
and hair. Yeah, and a while back with something called Camden Highline, we're doing a fundraiser.
Ah,
and you couldn't be there, and a woman came up. I was standing there with Fiona. Couple of people chatting away, and this woman came up to me and she said, I'm so pleased to meet you because I've admired you for so long and I love your work. And I said, well, I'm very grateful and thank you. And she said, and it must be incredible as you travel around the country and around the world and you see the consequence of what you've done. I said, well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very, very much indeed. And then she said, and I particularly liked it was the stuff up in Liverpool. And then I suddenly realized she thought I was you.
Oh, well, the penny only dropped at the very, very end.
Absolutely. I mean, I loved the first bit, yeah. Oh. Such an admirer of your work.
That's very funny.
Thank you.
Touching.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm sorry. I'm aware that this isn't quite the fair that your listeners...
I think our listeners will thoroughly enjoy it.
I think they'll love it.
Some of them might wish there was a bit more Tory bashing, but you did a bit of that. they might wish that there was a bit more... No, I thought your propagandising for Labour was excellent.
Oh, good. Well, I'm hoping Keir will listen to me.
I'm so excited you came on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Did you? And I also thought it was funny, this discovery that basically you are twins was kind of a good revelation at the end.
we're almost exactly the same height.
Yeah.
Quite similar build.
Yeah.
Quite big noses.
Yeah. Some big ears.
Haircut, yeah, very, very similar. Yeah. No, this woman was absolutely convinced I was here, but, and I was convinced that she was talking to me for at least the first 3 minutes. And it is true. Some of our listeners will probably think, you know, what's this got to do with politics? But actually, whenever we did get onto politics, he became even more kind of enervated than he was when talking about art. It was interesting. His we probably should have asked him about this, but he's now become a German citizen. He now has a German passport because his mother was German, and he was clearly thinks Brexit has been a total disaster. I was really cheered by his assessment of Keir Starmer because that was hope.
One of the best cases made for Keir Starmer that we've heard on the show, coming from an artist, not from a politician. And he was basically saying, in the end, he trusts his instincts. He trusts the fact that Keir understands what it meant for his father to be a toolmaker. He trusts that Keir will care about levelling up. He trusts that Keir will care about culture and art. It was a sort of case for Keir Starmer's character as being what gives him hope rather than his statements.
And it's interesting that he'd obviously met him quite recently and formed that impression quite strongly. And I honestly really do think, and I know he mentioned Thangam Debonair, who's the Shadow Secretary of State, whose background is classical music. And I think there's a huge gaping open door for Labour here to really to make arts and culture something really, really important again.
And it's partly, isn't it, that politics feels such a long way away from this. Mm. I mean, I guess if, you know, maybe a kind of different generation of politicians, maybe kind of some of Attlee's government, some of Wilson's government would have been very comfortable talking about art and sculpture and literature. But nowadays, professional politicians seem to be so far away from wanting to talk about painting or sculpture or novels. I mean, you know, Macmillan used to sort of, I think, show off about all these 19th century novels he'd be reading or some of
the only one I can think of in modern politics who is Nicola Sturgeon every year does a picture of all the novels that she's read, and it's vast numbers of them. And she has them, her bookshelves at home are all colour coordinated according to the sort of genre she's looking at.
But you get a sense that, you know, Michael Foot, for example, would have been much more comfortable having this conversation than most politicians today.
When you mentioned Michael Foot and books, when Michael Foot died, he was a very good friend of ours. We were given, with a small group of other people, first dibs on going around to his house and going through the tens of thousands of books that were there, most of which he had not only read, but actually had markings inside and jottings and so forth. But what I loved about it, I mean, I was mesmerized when you gave him the three objects that you brought in from your son, mesmerized with the way he was describing them and the effect that they were clearly having on him. And that thing he has about when he's talking, and I don't think there aren't many people who could persuade me to sit here and shut my eyes for 3 minutes, but that thing when he's concentrating and he shuts his eyes and it's almost like he's going off to a different place. And I guess he is kind of seeing things that become art.
I also think that there's something rather wonderful about his earnestness, that, you know, you and I might be a little inclined to giggle about closing our eyes or being serious in that way, but he's really serious without being pompous. I don't think he's pompous, but he really believes in what he's saying. He really believes it's important, and he's not embarrassed to talk about some very, very important things. And maybe you find that more in your German reading. It doesn't.
Well, and then as he left, he gave us both very, very large books, and mine is in German.
Yours in German.
He knew that he'd been compliment to
you. I think it's really lovely to have that and to have such an unusual voice being prepared to be so serious. Not a bullshitter in any way. I think you really feel
also, you know, he speaks so clearly. I mean, he says he likes making rather than speaking, but he speaks in kind of perfectly formed sentences. There's no umming and ahhing. He thinks and then he says it. And I thought, when I raised the thing about the Arts Council, he was visceral. You know, that was like it totally offended everything that he thinks about what this country should be and what the arts are for and the relationship they should have with politics. And I think the one thing that would absolutely get him to like Keir Starmer even more is if Keir Starmer and Thangam were to come out and say, look, part of the job of arts is to get up the nose of people like us.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, because that is part of the job of the arts.
It would be awful, awful if artists were not annoying politicians.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be a real sign that something terrible would happen.
Very bad side of something going very horribly wrong in our culture. Good. Well, I'd be fascinated to see what our listeners think about that. But that's our first. It's our first artist. First.
We
did Brian Cox, which is different, but it's a first. It's our first. Certainly, our first artist, professional artist, and he's definitely a leader. So, good stuff.
Thank you very much.
See you soon.